You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon. To most of us in this city, wildlife in New York might seem to consist entirely of pigeons, subway rats, and the Central Park Zoo, the denizens of the Central Park Zoo. But Marie Wynn has spent a lot of time observing surprising creatures who share this city with us, and she's written a book about them and the people who love them in her latest book, Central Park in the Dark, More Mysteries of Urban Wildlife. In it, she collects years of observations of everything from slug sex to fallen baby owls. And these are all observations she made during nocturnal expeditions into the wilds of Central Park. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings Marie Wynn to the Leonard Lopate Show. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. I love being here.
Okay, the first question I know everyone is thinking is, isn't it dangerous to go into Central Park at night?
Once upon a time, it really was dangerous. In my childhood, this was not a place you would go at night. But my childhood was quite a little while ago. And I don't think that its reputation is deserved. The park is a different place since the Central Park Conservancy took over. That is now a good 25 years ago. And I write in the book about two experiences that really made me go, uh-oh. I'm here to talk to you today, so nothing terrible happened. But that's it. And that covers a good number of years, maybe 15 years altogether that I've been going into the park and spending lots of time there at night.
Now, what drew you to the park at night at first? Was it someplace that you, because you've been in New York for much longer than the past 15 years, was there a moment where you thought, all right, now it's safe, now I think I can go in? Or was there something that said, that you said, I've got to see this?
It was that. It was, I've got to see it. And what drew me was something that happened in the day. Owls. Discovering an owl in the daytime is one of the great events of Central Park birding because, unlike other birds that quickly flitter in and then flitter out, owls are asleep during the day. So they are there. You can focus your binoculars and spend hours looking at them. And I've been doing that for many, many, many years. And maybe it was 15 years ago that there were two long-eared owls, beautiful, beautiful birds, that were discovered by some very observant person at Cedar Hill around 79th and 5th. And crowds would gather every day and watch them at the last moment of daylight as they took off into the mysterious dark. And one day a little group of us were standing there feeling that little tiny let down that you feel as your wonderful show is about to end. And we said, let's go. Let's see where they go. And it was a little scary. Everything new you do is a little scary. But that began it. That began a true addiction. We followed those owls, and then we followed many other owls. And then gradually you see there's other stuff going on.
You write about that moment of owl takeoff. And I was thinking about it. I was reading your book while I was on vacation, and one of the things we did was we went to a nature center where we looked at fish. And the woman explaining things to us said, when things are still, we have a very hard time seeing them. But when things move, it's much easier. And I wondered if the aviary world is different from the fish world in that you write a lot about looking at the owl as it's staying stock still and then start preening itself and then take off into the night.
Well, it's magical. That's all I can say. Maybe that's an overused word, but you're right. There is that contrast between the complete stillness of the sleeping owl, although, truth to tell, they're not sleeping all day long. Every once in a while, they open an eye, a dog will bark, or a truck will go by, and you see this is not a decoy. Once in a while, people go by and say, oh, that's a fake up there.
But, no. Like the ones you put on to scare away the pigeons.
Yeah, exactly. But no, they move a little bit during the day, too, but there is a kind of passivity about it, and then there's that impending action that is very compelling, and the moment itself, we call it the fly out. That somehow became the term for that magical moment. That moment is just terribly exciting. You then do want to follow them. You're hepped up.
To see where they go.
Yeah, and just to continue this experience.
Now, were you always someone who loved looking at the natural world, or was this something that happened to you at some point?
That's a good question. I would say as a kid, you're not aware of it, that you're a nature nick. But I guess I was. I lived in the city, so you don't have that many opportunities. I spent lots of time in Central Park, and I did look at bugs and stuff. And in the country, I remember my major childhood experience when we went for a weekend in the country was catching tadpoles, and then we'd bring them home and raise them to froghood. But so I guess so. But really, Central Park was the beginning for me of serious observation, and that's really because that place is chock full of people who know a lot more than you do.
Well, the people, you know, this is a book called Central Park in the Dark. It's about the creatures that live there, but it's also a story about the people who follow these creatures. And it seems like a very strong community, perhaps a loose community, but very strong of people who love to look at all of the things that live there.
You know, you take it for granted a little bit. These are the people who are around and you spend a lot of time with them, but they are an extraordinary community. And actually, I dedicated my book to that little core group that I think of as the night people. But it's a unique kind of community. The word community doesn't really apply to it the way when we think of our various communities we belong to, because you don't know that much about each other's life except in that sense that you are all interested in. So my thought really is you're a little bit like pilgrims on a pilgrimage together. You all have this overwhelming interest, and you're all thrown together with it, and you come to love each other. Really, I don't use that word too lightly, because you are following this interest, and you're passionate about it. But ordinarily, these are probably not the people of your group, you know, your little community in other senses.
I thought about it like what happens when you have little children and you join a nursery school, and all of a sudden the people that you're closest to are the other ones who have little children, because that is your kind of all-consuming thing. Here, it's a choice, and you've made this choice to be fascinated by moths or owls, or maybe it isn't a choice, maybe it just happens and you find yourself drawn to them. But I found the people as interesting as the creatures in your book.
Oh, I'm happy to hear this. This is not entirely a creature book. It's sort of a people book, but I don't give long biographies of them. I just let them reveal themselves.
Through their passions for these creatures.
Well, I think you've put your finger on it, though, really. This is an unusual group. And each one of them is unusual in their own way. So I'm happy to think that people enjoy that part of it, too.
You were drawn to the park at night because of owls, and we'll get to them in a minute. But your next fascination was moths. Why are moths? You know, most of us think of moths as things that either go to the light on the porch or we're afraid are going to eat our clothes. What's beautiful and intriguing about moths?
Well, think about butterflies. Nobody asks what's intriguing about butterflies. Everybody knows that butterflies are very beautiful. Well, moths are very beautiful, too. People are kind of hung up on those little clothes moths, those little boring brown critters that you find in your closet, and have no idea that there are these huge, colorful creatures who open their wings, and there is bright orange and black or, you know, velvety, almost blue-black underwings, or sphinx moths that look like hummingbirds and so on. These are rarely beautiful. I think that's part of it. The other part of the fascination is how difficult the identification, the challenge
yes.
of it. Most of us are also bird watchers, and I would say all of the night people began that way, and also as hawk watchers with pale male, and, you know, there's a sort of interconnection there. But the mysteries of the moths and their incredible difficulty. Don't forget you have 600 and some odd species of birds in North America, and you have something like 10,000 moths in that area. So your field guide, and there's only one, and I write about it, that we are not happy with it, can't include everything. So you see a moth, you try to identify it, and you know it's not even going to be in there, damn it. So,
and it's one of 700 that look similar and maybe have a slightly different stripe in a slightly different place.
Yes, you do hone your observational skills. You definitely do. Your brain changes, I would say, once you focus in that way.
I'm speaking with Marie Nguyen, and she is author of Central Park in the Dark, More Mysteries of Urban Wildlife. In the book, you stray a little bit north of Central Park, and you talk about an owl that arrives in Harlem. What? Tell us about this owl, and who found it?
That was, I couldn't resist putting it in, and there was a slight connection because that owl did end up in Central Park briefly. But this was a kid who lived in a project in East Harlem. I remember him very well, Brandon Shackelford. And I was thinking, this kid is probably now grown up because this happened quite a few years ago. And one day he looked out of his window and, oh my God, there on a tree that was in the sort of backyard of his project was this huge creature. He didn't even know it was an owl. He just saw that it was big and that it was looking at him. And he showed his mother and his sister, and then he went to school and he mentioned it to a teacher. And the teacher took the trouble to go in his lunch hour to Brandon's project and there saw that it was an owl. He didn't know what kind it was, but he recognized what the critter was and called the Audubon Society, and that was the beginning. Every birdwatcher in New York landed in that East Harlem project.
What was it like for you and your birdwatching colleagues to be watching a bird in a very different environment from what you had been doing in Central Park?
Well, I tried to describe that in the book. There was something a little bit different about it. This was not your usual Central Park birdwatchers. And we were kind of ashamed afterwards to feel that our really prejudices that this was a tough neighborhood had come out so that our normal instincts to share our binoculars, which are very expensive optical equipment, were a little bit, you know, we were a little hesitant. But that passed very, very quickly. These folks there were just like anybody else. They were fascinated by this really beautiful, extraordinary creature. I don't know if you can imagine how unusual it is to be right in the heart of the city and see a large owl. It's shocking, and it's wonderful, and I bet you that none of them will ever forget it.
When you are looking at owls in Central Park, how do you find one? I know you write about how you may not be the best person to find one, that your friend Noreen was someone who often spotted them.
That's true. Noreen was brilliant at spotting, but we have a little outside help outside of the owl group, and that is birds in the neighborhood, and especially blue jays or crows, have an instinct when they see an owl to go into a behavior that's called mobbing. They don't want that owl there because owls are predators, and they will begin to scream. They'll focus all their attention on that. Even if they see an outline, they will start attacking, really. I've seen blue jays attacking a great horned owl.
That's astonishing, because blue jays are, they're big, but they're not as big as a great horned
owl.
Well,
I've seen chickadees.
Chickadees.
Pecking. It's simply, and somehow or other, evolution has arranged it so that somehow they are safe doing it. I've never heard of any of the mobbers ever being damaged by the predator.
So you need not just to be keen-eyed, but you need to be keen-eared to find
birds. It doesn't take much to hear the mob. They're screaming and yelling, and all you have to do is know that when you hear a lot of birds screaming, look around, find where they're screaming. It's going to be a hawk or an owl. That's how we find hawks, too. So I would say to listeners here, if you hear a lot of birds making a big racket, look around. You'll always find something good.
That's exciting. And that's good for radio, too. One day we'll have to record that and bring it on. On the cover of your book is a beautiful little screech owl.
It is a screech owl, and it was taken by one of our group, too, which is also very exciting. Bruce Yolton's the guy who took that picture, and he was a regular owl person. He was very involved in our story, and they put his picture on the book. It's so great.
And those screech owls figure very prominently. They really are kind of a through line through the book. But they are not creatures that, at least for the past 50 or 70 years, are native to, they're native to Central Park, but they died out after a while.
That's right. They didn't exactly come in the way all the other Central Park birds do, that is, of their own choice. They were part of a project that was called Project X that had its purpose to reintroduce species that had once been in various parks in New York and had become, as they say, extirpated. In other words, they weren't there anymore. Screech owls had been nesters in the park, and then since the early 1950s, they vanished. So they were one of the species that Project X decided they would try to introduce, and we were very against it. Us birdwatchers just thought, well, there was some reason why they were extirpated, and let's not fool around. These are living animals. But we got very involved. They were enchanting creatures and became great fans of Project X in the end.
We only have a minute, but you did seem to fall in love with these birds. And one of the things you write about is the fact that we're very leery of anthropomorphizing creatures these days, but it's something that it seems like it's hard not to do. I could tell from the way that you were describing these screech owls that you had a real connection with these creatures.
We certainly did, and I'm sorry we don't have time for me to go into my defense of anthropomorphism, but there is
you can have a little one.
if you don't do it in a disgusting way, we don't like to name our animals, though it's awkward to call the female of the West Drive nest, but so on. But there is a connection. After all, through evolution, we're all connected. And animals do have emotions. They're just a little bit different from ours. So we were very connected. I have wept tears over those owls, and some readers have too, I understand.
Well, Marie Wynne, thank you so much for coming in to talk with me today about your new book, Central Park in the Dark, which is published by Farrar, Straus & Drew.
Thank you very, very much.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.